So I wanted to talk today about community, family, community. What brought me to that was several weeks ago, I was in, Angie and I were in Colorado visiting my son and his family. And on his bookshelf, I happened to see this book, which is actually an old book of mine. Either I'd given it to my son or he'd taken it from me, called A Joyful Path, Community Transformation and Peace, that I think was published on the 12th anniversary of Plum Village, Thich Nhat Hanh's community in Paris. So that was 1994. And I have to be honest with you, even though I've been reading Thai and hearing Thai for getting on to 40 or 50 years, every time I have the opportunity, I am always struck by his freshness and clarity and originality. So I opened it up, and the first thing is a poem of his on the front piece. Let me read it. Some of you may know it. It's called The Good News. The good news, they do not print. The good news, we do print. We have a special edition every moment, and we need you to read it. The good news is that you are alive, that the linden tree is still there, standing firm in the harsh winter. The good news is that you have wonderful eyes to touch the blue sky. The good news is that your child is there before you, your arms are available. Hugging is possible. They only print what is wrong. Look at each of our special editions. We are always offering things that are not wrong. We want you to benefit from them and help protect them. The dandelion is there by the sidewalk, smiling its wondrous smile, singing the song of eternity. Listen, you have ears that can hear it. Bow your head, listen to it. Leave behind the world of sorrow, of preoccupation, and get free. The latest good news is that you can do it. I could probably spend the whole hour just on this, but I mean, there it is, right? Having the, you know, as I said, I spent the most of the week in isolation, which fortunately or unfortunately gave me more time, and since I wasn't feeling like doing much, I spent more time than usual attending to what's called the news. And so I'm very struck by this poem because, you read the news, it's never good news. It's always watering seeds that do not nurture our capacity to see what's good in our own life right now, what's good in life right now, what's always available to us. Because I think our current media world is such a conspiracy to prevent us from touching, being aware of all the good things that are available to us, and always trying to ensnare us in a world of endless information, information that often agitates us, endless distraction, endless escapism, that the simplicity of ties, we still have eyes that can see beautiful things. This doesn't mean we have to go to the museums. We can look at the blue sky. We can look at flowers. We can look at people. We can look at ourselves and realize, yeah, I still have eyes that can see. I still have ears that can hear, a nose that can smell, a mouth that can taste. Actually, I've been not tasting things in the past week, which is very interesting. You know, I'm still aware. I can still be aware of things. I could still think loving, compassionate thoughts. I mean, there's so much available to me. But unfortunately, our culture does not nurture those things, to just say it simply. So Ty writes this good news saying, over here, I have some good news for you. Please attend to it. The dandelion is still there by the sidewalk, smiling its wondrous smile. Leave behind the world of sorrow, of preoccupation, and get free. You know, please, please, all of you, hear that. This is the message of Dharma. That this is always available to us, no matter what the external circumstances. So that was the first thing. When I opened up this book that I hadn't probably seen in decades. And then the first chapter was an article. This thing is in a really anthology, and most of it is by people sort of writing about their experiences at Plum Village back in the first 12 years. The first article is by Thich Nhat Hanh called Community as a Resource, which I want to read today and comment on. But when I got back home, I went to my bookshelf because, again, I'm always struck by Thay, and I pulled out this book called Joyfully Together, The Art of Building a Harmonious Community. And this, as I say, the other one was 1994, this was 2003. So and in Thay's introduction, I was struck anew by his words. He begins in the introduction, "Ever since I was a young monk, my dream has to build a happy Sangha." For those of you not familiar, Sangha is a Sanskrit word for really, you know, the Buddhist community or a spiritual community. Then he said, "Now, after 60 years of monastic practice, I continue to feel that Sangha building is the most precious work that we can do." You know, I was struck by the power of the clarity of his, "This is the most precious." Precious means the most valuable, most important. The most precious thing that we can do as practitioners of this way is to build a community. And as I said, and I did this a little earlier this morning, I thought, well, let me see, based on my week of isolation and attending to the news, if I was attending to the news and what seems to be being projected, I would think the most important thing I need to do is to do something about abortion and abortion rights, to do something about racial justice, to do something about economic and social inequalities, to do something about war and violence, to do something about attacks on our democracy and loss of voting rights, to do something about the drug epidemic, to do something about teen suicide, to do something about the anxiety and depression among young people, to do something about climate change, to do something about the rise of extremism in its many facets. And that's just page one. Okay, is that clear? I thought, hold on a second. Based on if I was getting my information about life from the news, I would have a laundry list. And again, I could probably go on for pages of the most important thing for me to do now for this world. And then I go back to this. After 60 years of monastic practice, I continue to feel that Sangha building is the most precious work that we can do as practitioners. And I thought, even though he says, you know, after 60 years of monastic practice, as you all know, he is not, Thich Nhat Hanh has never been a recluse. He was very involved in his society in the civil war that was in Vietnam. He was a very strong advocate for peace. He was one of the earliest advocates warning us about climate change and the deterioration of our ecosystem. I remember him 40, 50 years ago talking about poverty and hungry children. So it's not as if he's been a recluse in a monastery. He's a man who's considered the father of socially engaged Buddhism, right? And yet here he is saying, after 60 years, I continue to feel that Sangha building is the most precious work that we can do as practitioners. The Sangha is our community of practice. It is also our refuge. We rely on it and trust it to support our deepest aspiration and give us energy and inspiration on the path of practice. You know, and when I read this, and I'm very struck by it, very moved by it, and realize that he's also, since he is such a person of the world, since he is somebody who has taught and has students all over the world, he's not simply talking about Sangha or spiritual community for us, you know, the members, you see, that we have to do it for ourselves. I think what he's getting at is we need to do it because of this list, you see, because of this endless list, these endless symptoms of a fundamentally ill world. It is because of this world we need to build healthy communities, places where people can come to learn another way to live, to learn another way to be, to learn another way to interact. And before I go to the joyful path, I was also reflecting, and it's not as if I haven't known it, but somehow it really struck me this time. For those of you who are aware of the historical Buddha, Siddhartha, later known as Shakyamuni Buddha, he did a very unique thing that many religious founders don't do. he worked diligently to build a community. It struck me this time. I mean, we know that he had a community, like most great religious founders, gather disciples around them. But he did not just gather disciples around him. I mean, or disciples, we might say, gathered around him. He wasn't propagating, but disciples gathered around him. But what happened historically was, because of the nature of Indian society, many of his followers were of two types. Well, more than two types. But at that time, there were many communities of kind of homeless ones, religious practitioners who lived in spiritual communities or wandered around with their teachers. I mean, this was common in India. So when he taught, a lot of his followers were people who came out of these other spiritual communities. And since they already were homeless, they just started following him, as well as he went from village to village and gave talks. There were many lay people who kind of went, you know, I want to follow this guy. I want to be with him. So he ended up having hundreds, if not thousands, of followers. And then we see what he did. He very, and if you read the Vinaya and other texts, he very consciously worked to build that group of followers into a community, into an organization that had a structure, that had precepts, that had values, that had ways of resolving differences. You know, we'll talk a little more about it, but it really struck me that, isn't that interesting? Right from the beginning, the Buddha didn't just collect a sangha like followers. He right away put a lot of his conscious energy into building and sustaining a community. A community that could therefore be a vehicle, be a conduit, be a container to hold his teachings, to hold his values, long after his passing. So in that sense, coming back to Thay's statement about the most precious thing we can do is build a sangha, I realize he's really doing the same thing that the Buddha did. I mean, again, we know the Buddha advised all kinds of people about all kinds of worldly issues. We know he advised kings. We know that when he was in touch with warring parties, he was often called upon to remediate and negotiate. I mean, it wasn't as if he wasn't helping the world, so to speak, in any way he could. But he was very clearly, very consciously building a spiritual community. So I just wanted to kind of introduce this more targeted thing I want to share with you this morning with that. So coming back to this text, A Joyful Path, Community Transformation and Peace by Thich Nhat Hanh and Friends. Again, I think I gave this to my son because he has something in here. He, in the 90s at some point, he and a group of other teenagers who were at Plum Village, they wrote a rap song. I don't know if people use the word rap anymore, but they, I guess that was popular among young people. So they wrote a rap song about Siddhartha. And they called him Cool Kid Sid. That was the name. But anyhow, his rap song is in here. So this is Ty writing about community as a resource. And I'll speak a little about why I was struck by this. So the Buddha, this is from a sutra, which is, you know, purported teachings of the Buddha. So the Buddha was visiting a small community of three monks in a bamboo forest near Kosambi. They're named. They were happy to see the Buddha. They made a place for him. They joined their palms. They sat down. He inquired, you know, how's your practice going? Are you content here? Do you encounter any difficulties when begging for alms, sharing the teachings? And they answered, no, we are most content here. It is calm, peaceful, we receive ample food, we're able to share the Dharma, we're making progress in our practice. And then the Buddha said to them, you know, that might have been enough, you see. But he said something very interesting. The Buddha said, do you live in harmony? You know, I think this is profound. Because most of the time when we inquire to people, you know, how are you doing? You know, and people will say, oh, yeah, I'm doing good. You know, my work is going well, or, you know, finances are good, and, you know. But we never ask the question. Or they might say about family, yeah, family is well, you know, nobody's sick, this is what the kids are doing at school, and this is, you know, this is how the job is going, and this will be a good plan for vacation, you know what I mean? We don't ask, are you living in harmony with the people of your life? I think this is what I really want to share with you today, because I think in very much that is often a missing piece, that we don't focus enough on. So Anuruddha, one of the monks, replied, yes, we do live in harmony. Living with Nandiya and Kambila, which are the two other monks, is a great blessing for me. I treasure their friendship. Before saying or doing anything, I always reflect on whether my words or actions will be helpful for my brothers. If I feel any doubt, I refrain from speaking or acting. Because even though we are three, we are also one. So this is why I titled my talk, Community is Family, Family is Community. Because I think what's being shared here is significant, whether we are in a spiritual community, whether we live in a family, or whether we just live with friends and roommates. You know, we have work colleagues. Do we really ask ourselves, am I in harmony? Do I live in harmony? Do I work in harmony with the people in my life? Do I always reflect whether my words or actions will be helpful for others? I mean, the societal implications of these are monumental. But, today we'll just stick with the personal. This simple, it's so simple. In Buddhism, we call this right speech. We call it mindfulness. I am aware, I am mindful of my words. Not just as words that come out of me, you see, which is sort of self-centered. I am mindful of my words and their effects on others. I mean, if you think, why do we speak? I mean, you know, we could just stay home and talk to ourselves all day, you know, if we just were, you know, interested in having a conversation with somebody who basically thinks we're wonderful and totally agrees with us. We could just fundamentally just talk to ourselves all day. But we talk with others all the time. And yet, am I speaking with that kind of awareness that my words are having effects? That once they leave my mouth and enter another's ears, they are having effects. Cause and effect. And effects cause response. And so, in this great interrelationship, interaction of speech, which is again the overwhelmingly primary way we relate to each other. Right? We don't, you know, there may be facial gestures, there may be hand gestures, there may be body language. But I'd say that, you know, most of our communication is with words. And yet, do I have that awareness about the words that I'm speaking and their effects on others? But even backing it up, do I live with the intention in my own mind that my words or actions are going to be helpful to whoever I'm speaking to? And then with that criteria, do we do as Anuruddha said, if I have any doubt, I refrain from speaking or acting? Again, very, you know, simple. This is not the deepest truth of the empty nature of the mind. This is a truth that I think is very, very meaningful for all of us, because we're all in relationships. We're all communicating with. People are communicating to us. We know. I think all of us know. Why don't we take a moment just to reflect? Is my mind state, or my thoughts, or my emotion affected by the words of others? Ask yourself, in the last 24 hours, have the words of others affected me, positively and negatively? See, sometimes our ability to be aware of the effects of my words and actions, behaviors on others can be limited. But we have this incredible realm of experience we all have, which is what it's happening to us, you see. So if we turn it around and go, oh, how am I affected by the words of others? How does that affect me? How does that color my mind? And I think if we reflect this way, we would have to admit, yes, significantly. So then doesn't it behoove me to be aware, even more so, since I can't control all the words that are spoken to me? even though I probably wish I could, but I can exercise some self-control, self-awareness over my own words. Do I have the intention in my mind always to always speak constructively, that my words always be helpful, that my words nurture the wholesome in people? You know, as my little, takeaway on the effects of the news on our psyche, you know, do we really need to nurture people's anger, fear, despair? Aren't there enough societal avenues that are doing that? So in my little piece of this human complexity and interbeing, interrelationship, what do I want to do? How do I want to affect people? What kind of force, you know? I would say, we all probably would say, yeah, I want to be a force for good in this world. I want to be a force for the wholesome. But, you know, it's one thing to say that, and I'm sure when we say it, we mean it. But if we don't tie that into a clear intention that in the actions of our body, speech, and mind, we manifest that, even in our most intimate relationships, not just publicly, then am I really fulfilling the words I speak? So when Anuruddha said, yeah, that I always reflect whether my words or actions will be helpful for my brothers, if I feel any doubt, I refrain from speaking and acting. We are three, but we are one. The Buddha nodded in assent, looked at the other two monks, you know, sort of to get their assent. And Kambila said, Anuruddha speaks the truth. We live in harmony. We care deeply for each other. And then Nandiya added, we share all things, our food, our insight, our experience. The Buddha praised them. I am most pleased to hear how you live. A community is truly a community when there is harmony. You demonstrate real awakening. So we can say a good relationship is a good relationship when there is harmony. And that harmony is based on what we're hearing now, and now we'll get into it, which is, I get a kick out of this because a lot of the sutras are not very personal, but you'll see what goes on here. Let me read it. And I thought that's where I thought, oh, this is the model for family life. So the Buddha stayed with these three monks for a month. He observed the way they went begging each morning after meditation. In those days, for those who are unfamiliar with Buddhist history, monks, they didn't keep food. Every day they had to go into whatever village was close by and beg for their food. This was the relationship. And in return, if wanted, they would share some dharma with whatever household they were getting food from. So he observed the way they went begging each morning after their morning meditation. What I was struck next is by the selfless way they live. Look, listen to how sweet this is. Whoever returned first prepared a place for the other two, gathered water for washing, and set out an empty bowl into which he would place some food in case one of his brothers did not receive enough offerings. So this is, I just got a kick out of this. You know, we are such scorekeepers. Hold on a second. Wasn't I the one who just prepared a place yesterday or made dinner yesterday? I mean, you understand how we do it. Didn't I wash the dishes yesterday? Didn't I, you know, blah, blah, blah. And here they go. Whoever returns first prepared the place for the other two. They gathered water for washing. They set out an empty bowl. And they put some food in there in case one of the others didn't have enough food. So what do we notice? This quality, very simple, that they cared for one another and they weren't just focused on their own needs. They saw the needs of the group as their needs. They saw the well-being of the group as their well-being. And I thought, what a model for family life, right? That everybody in the family, everybody in relationships, whatever they were, they had that kind of awareness. I'm here to take care of your needs too. I'm here to take care of your happiness too. You know, that's what I'm here for. I'm not here just to make sure my own needs, you know, I mean, the other way would be, you know, the first one to get back sits down and eats their food. My needs first. Gathers water, prepares a place for the other two. And they seem to be happy to do this. They seem to get happiness at taking care of their family members, the other two. Making sure that their needs were met before they took care of their own. After all three monks finished eating, they placed their leftover food on the ground or in the stream, careful not to harm any of the creatures who live there. They washed their bowls together. When one of them noticed that something needed tending, he did it at once. And all of them worked together on tasks that required more than one person. And they sat together regularly to share their insights and experiences. Again, I thought, what a model. What a model for relationship, for family life, you know, for work, you know. When you noticed something needed taken care of, you just did it. When there were tasks that were, you know, required more one person, they joined right in. What is it that holds us back? This is a reflective. What is it that holds us back? Why do we nitpick? Why do we parse? Why do we assess and evaluate? Rather than just coming from this place, really we could say of love. You know, where we just naturally, spontaneously, without being asked. I guess that's a big thing, you know. Without being asked. Can I help you? Oftentimes we wait for somebody to say, can you help me? But where are we that we don't notice what's needed to be done? And that we just can't freely openly, joyfully offer ourselves. You know, I realize, you know, we live in a highly individualistic society, where a lot of the interrelationships and interdependence, those bonds are not as strong as they were, if at all. We are more focused, you know, I guess today is the day, or tomorrow, right? You know, Independence Day. We are people who value our personal independence. We don't value our interdependence with others. Maybe this is one of the reasons we see a growing divisiveness and fragmentation in our society. We are so focused on me, my needs, my wants, my views, my ideas, and not on the we, not on the interconnection, the interdependence, not on the sameness of the commonality with. So in reading this, you know, it's just a very different a way of approaching relationships, family, and community. And therefore, you know, you could, as I said, we could build it on up, you know, into a society. Before leaving the bamboo forest, the Buddha told the three monks, "The nature of a community is harmony, and harmony can be realized by following the six concords." Now, when we get to the six concords, we're talking about, you know, in Buddha's teachings, there are endless numbers. You know, the two of this, the three of this, the six of this, the eight of this, the 12 of this. So these are the six concords. And this is Thay's, Thich Nhat Hanh's interpretation. He says, the first is the sharing of common space. This is the first. So concord means agreement, harmony. So the first concord is that we are in harmony with those that we share our physical space with. Many of us in various places in our life, we share physical space with family members, with roommates, with workmates. You know, is there harmony with those that I share physical space with? The second harmony is the sharing the essentials of life. So, you know, sleeping arrangements, food, all the various ways we kind of share our life together. Is that in harmony? Do we live in harmony with each other? Are we aware of each other, and do we do our best to make sure that the needs of everyone are being taken care of? I mean, it's, you know, one could certainly move out into the broader community and world, you know, and then we could see where things begin to, you know, things can begin in the small space of our own relationships, but we can see as it moves out into the world, you know, the world, the people, the animals, you know, that we inhabit our physical space. Are we in harmony with the people that we share our physical world with? Our cities, our towns, our country. Do we share the benefits? You know, the essentials, Are we all concerned that everyone have enough to eat? That everyone have enough to drink? That everyone, you know, the essentials, shelter, housing, medical care, you know. Are we creating harmony? Or is there divisiveness, disharmony in these areas? The third is observing the same precepts. So this really has to do with that there's some kind of commonality, some kind of harmony and agreement. So let's just come back to, you know, our relationships. Is there a commonality of values? Right? Do we share the same values around, you know, preciousness of life, around speaking truthfully, around honesty, around loving constructive speech, about the use of alcohol and drugs, around sexuality, you know, I mean, do we share I mean, it doesn't have to be rigid, but a general kind of ethical, moral, value, whatever you want to call it, framework that we're in harmony about. Because you can see as we move out from the, you know, the physical to kind of the essential of just life, things that just nurture life, you know, primarily physically. And now as we get into kind of human beings and they're living together, you know, is there harmony? Do we share, you know, some fundamental principles, values, in how to conduct ourselves in this life to each other? Is there harmony, you see? And if there's not harmony, if there's disharmony, if there's conflict, then you can see kind of, you know, this other road that opens up, both for the couple, both for the family, both for the workplace, and of course, you know, for society as this unfolds. The fourth concord, the fourth is speech. Our speech also needs to inspire harmony. We need to base our speaking on certain principles. I'm reading from Todd. Such as knowing how not to react when we hear something we do not like, knowing how to make note of what the other says in order to be able to meditate on it, reflect on it deeply before we reply, and knowing how to encourage and increase the confidence of those we talk to. So is this, you know, again, I mean, a lot of times when I deal with people who are in conflict, in relationships, it is because of this, these reasons. There is no agreement. Concord means agreement. There's no agreement on how we are to speak to one another, how we are to conduct our lives together. How we resolve conflict together. And oftentimes, when this is not present in people's lives, then, you know, suffering occurs. And often that suffering cannot be mended because people don't have a framework to mending it. The fifth concord is sharing insights and understanding. Ty writes, we come from different backgrounds. We cannot possibly share the views and understanding of everyone in the community, but we do not have to assume that our view is correct and others' views are wrongs. We don't argue about our different views. When we have an idea, we share it with other members of our community, of our family, of our Sangha, and we modify our ideas as we listen to others. So this is somewhat what we're trying to model on our Tuesday nights, right? Can we listen to other people without judging, without pointing out they're right or wrong, or I'm right or wrong, you know, without any of that? Can we listen? And are we willing to take it in and modify? This is unbelievable for some of us. You know, am I really willing to listen deeply to somebody who has a different view than myself, freshly, cleanly, perhaps see the reasons for it, the logic of it, or why somebody can see that way? And could that possibly modify the way I view things, or at least how I view them? Tai goes on, a Dharma discussion is an opportunity to listen carefully to all different viewpoints in order to have deeper insight. Our own ideas are only one small part of a bigger picture. When others speak, we listen carefully to find the wisdom in their words. Many of us, when we listen to others, especially people of different opinions, we are listening to, you know, how can I now go on the attack? You know, how can I refute? How can I show them they're wrong? You see, we're not even listening. Our own ideas are only one small part of a large picture. When others speak, we listen carefully to find the wisdom in their words. If we cannot listen to others, we cannot learn. We need, this is his words, we need to help others know they are accepted and appreciated. You know, right now, with so much polarization and divisiveness in certain sectors of our society, how many of us have that opportunity? Make use of that opportunity to listen deeply to those who have different views than us, and to show respect for their views, even if they're an anathema to us, to show them that we appreciate them. As human beings, we acknowledge that, you know, we are not the holders of truth. We would certainly hope that people we disagree with, all of us would certainly hope that they would know that they're not the holders of truth, right? That would make us really feel good if they admitted to us, oh, yeah, I can see the truth in what you're saying. See, you see how happy we'd be? But how willing are we to extend that to others? And the sixth concord is the concord, that was a viewpoints, that was insights and understandings. We're willing to share that with each other. And the sixth is respecting each other's viewpoints. They sort of, you can see that they're building a model here, these six concords. And Tai says, we have different ways of thinking and different feelings. We should not isolate ourselves on the island of our own thinking. We have to communicate. When we see someone drowning in their thinking, their sadness, their suffering, we can say to them, this is his own words, a penny for your thoughts, a penny for your feelings. When the other person is able to share his feeling, they're no longer isolated. When we express what is happening in our mind to another person, it relieves our isolation. If you ask somebody, what are you feeling, and they say, I'm unhappy, can you do things that'll bring them joy? Yeah, so the one before seemed to be more about sharing views, sharing insights, sharing ideas. This last one is a willingness to be present to another human being in terms of their own internal experiences. And one of the mindfulness trainings of the Order of Interbeing, it says, be present to suffering. Do not turn away from suffering. The suffering of others, the suffering of the world, your own suffering. Learn to be present. So again, you know, we see somebody, how you doing? Oh, everything's good. But you look at them, and you, if you look, you can see. You can often see the sadness. You can often see the agitation. You can see by the way they look that something's amiss. Are we courageous enough, kind enough, to say, what's going on with you? What are you feeling right now? What's in your mind right now? For many people, that's kind of a scary thing. Oftentimes, we don't even ask ourselves those questions. But, you know, to ask an open, sort of an open question like that to another human being has to be willing to listen to what they say. To be open to what they say. And, you know, that takes a certain degree of caring about other human beings, but a certain kind of confidence in your own ability to stay present to another human being and have a conversation with them that could be revealing and may not be what you expected. You know, this is where relationships, you know, get very creative. When you're willing to enter the world of another human being without an agenda. Just letting them know, I care about you. What's going on with you? What are you feeling? What are you thinking? Even if it's around about me, you know. About yourself, about life, you know, what's going on? I want to know. I'm here for you. I have a calligraphy by Thay. It says, I am here for you. You know, what greater gift can you give another human being than to let them know I am here for you? So family is community, community is family. So these six concords, and the way very personally the three monks express their life with each other, their caring for each other, to me is a good model for us, both in our personal relationships, but also in building our community. Can we build a community without self being our focus? Where really we learn to nurture and support and care for others, the greater good, rather than always my good. Am I willing to, you know, be present to all kinds of people? You know, when you enter a community, not everyone's going to be a saint. You know, it's a wide open door. I often say to people, we are not a very exclusive community, the Florida community of mindfulness. I mean, all you can do is check a few boxes and sign up, you know, which is good, you know. So, you know, all kinds of people come, and when we get to know each other, when we work with each other, when we interact with each other, when we're open and concerned about each other, we will hear all kinds of things. We will learn all kinds of things about other human beings. We will have a great opportunity to practice these six concords. So circling back, you know, to what Ty said, the most precious thing that we can do. Doesn't mean that we don't, there aren't, as I made my little list, of which was just a small list. There are many, 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 many sufferings in this world, indignities in this world, injustices in this world. The list is endless. And there's nothing wrong with doing our best when we can. But what the world really needs is to see there is another way for people to live. You know, and to demonstrate that, not just to talk it, not just to write about it, but to demonstrate it in a living way. And so hopefully all our relationships, and, you know, not just our Sangha, not just in our spiritual community, but all our relationships, we can manifest these six concords together. So that's it from COVID Central. I bow to everyone. I can see time is running out. Thank you for listening to my rantings this morning. Please enjoy the holiday weekend.